KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Former President Biden has cancer. His office says it metastasized, but that it still can be managed. We bring in a doctor to analyze what that diagnosis means in this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. Years after leaving the European Union, the UK decides it may need Europe after all. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The British won't try to undo Brexit, but they are attending their first summit with the EU since the breakup. Also, a man in the wreckage of Gaza calls to give the perspective from his tent. And Leo XIV gives the perspective of a new pope. It's Monday, May 19th. This day in 1962, the film star Marilyn Monroe appeared at a Democratic fundraiser and sang Happy Birthday to President John F. Kennedy. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A watchdog group is suing the Trump administration for allegedly withholding public records. In a new lawsuit, the group, American Oversight, is accusing multiple agencies of violating the Freedom of Information Act. NPR's Luke Garrett reports.
The watchdog group says the White House is breaking federal law by blocking the release of its records. Here's American Oversight Executive Director Chiomo Chukwu.
Our lawsuit seeks to compel the IRS, the Department of Treasury, and Department of Education to release records that they're unlawfully withholding from the public.
The group is seeking White House communications regarding President Trump's attacks against Harvard University. The White House has criticized Harvard for not doing enough to protect Jewish students and cut billions in grants to the university. But Chukwu says the suit is about more than just Harvard.
Today is Harvard. Tomorrow it could be any university.
The White House did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel is going to allow some food aid to get into Gaza. Israel has blocked all relief aid from reaching Palestinians in the territory, raising fears of famine. The Israeli government is trying to pressure Hamas to release hostages. NPR's Daniel Estrin says some Israelis do not want Netanyahu to allow any supplies to reach Palestinians.
And Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been facing right-wing criticism in Israel about renewing this food. And he said, look, we would not be able to continue to have international support for our offensive in Gaza if there is mass starvation. He said, we're going to take control of Gaza. We need to do it in a way that they won't stop us.
NPR's Daniel Estrin reporting. Separately, Israel has launched an expansive ground offensive in northern Gaza. Palestinians are reporting constant and heavy bombing and shelling. Telecommunications company Verizon is the latest big company to scale back on diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts under pressure from the federal government. NPR's Maria Aspen reports the Federal Communications Commission gave Verizon its blessing on Friday for a $20 billion deal.
Many big companies are backing away from what's known as DEI after once promising to create more equitable opportunities for all employees. But now, President Trump has declared such programs illegal, and the Federal Communications Commission has taken a big role in trying to pressure companies to do away with them. For example, Verizon has been seeking approval to buy Frontier, a broadband provider. So it told the FCC that it would end many of its policies relating to diversity, equity, and inclusion. Verizon will no longer set goals to hire more minorities, and it will remove references to DEI from its websites. Now the FCC has approved Verizon's deal, and it specifically cited Verizon's promise to end DEI-related practices. Maria Aspen, NPR News, New York.
On Wall Street, stocks are lower. The Dow Jones Industrials are down more than 20 points. You're listening to NPR. The White House says President Trump has begun his phone call with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Trump has been pushing for an end to Russia's war in Ukraine. The White House says Trump will speak with the leader of Ukraine and NATO officials later. More than a quarter of adults in the U.S. report having a disability, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But in the medical field, the number is less than 3%. NPR's Kristen Wright has this report on a California woman who filed a civil rights complaint in an effort to change that.
Taylor Carty's complaint to the Justice Department alleges Wayne State University School of Medicine in Detroit accepted but then denied her admission because of her disability. Carty has cerebral palsy. Limited mobility in her hand made it hard to meet the med school's technical standards. These are required skills set by each school. Carty asked for modifications to perform CPR and suture a wound, but Wayne State said her request for accommodations wasn't reasonable. She's focused on changing the rules.
I know there is a young child who is putting on that stethoscope, and I want to make that accessible for them.
Since 2021, the Association of American Medical Colleges has encouraged med schools to make their technical standards more inclusive. Wayne State declined to talk to NPR. Kristen Wright, NPR News.
In case you missed it over the weekend, Austria won this year's Eurovision Song Contest. The Austrian contestant JJ beat out 25 other competitors for the top prize. Eurovision has launched other groups to stardom, like ABBA. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
And we do thank you for joining us this morning here at KUAC. The time right now is 7:06, and we have been listening to the NPR News. Morning Edition is next. It is 45 degrees in Fairbanks, and we're looking at high temperatures around 60 degrees for today in the Fairbanks area, with some scattered rain showers, mainly after 1 o'clock this afternoon. Chance of precipitation for today is 30%. Showers for tonight as well, with low temperatures around 40, and showers will continue on tomorrow morning. High temperatures around 60 degrees and with light winds. Record temperatures for today in Fairbanks, 2023. The record high was met all the way up at 80 degrees, and the record low was 20 degrees back in 1918. Total daylight for today is 19 hours and 12 minutes. Sunrise was at 4:12 this morning. Sunset will be at 11:24 tonight. We will be gaining another 6 minutes and 55 seconds of daylight tomorrow. And pollen counts for today: spruce, willow, and poplar are in the low range, and alder and birch are in the high range.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Coming up, what does an election in Romania tell us about the political direction of Europe?
First, though, former President Biden has been diagnosed with prostate cancer, and it has spread to his bones.
The news from his office comes as new attention is focused on the president's decline while in office.
We're joined now by NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith to discuss. Good morning, Tam.
Good morning.
So, Tam, what do you know about the diagnosis?
Yeah, according to a statement from Biden's personal office, the cancer was detected after he experienced increasing urinary symptoms, and it has metastasized to his bones and is a more aggressive form of prostate cancer. The statement says it appears to be hormone sensitive, which means there are options for effective management, and the former president and his family are reviewing treatment options with his physicians. Prostate cancer is the most common cancer in elderly men, and Biden is 82 years old. He was the oldest president in U.S. history. And there has been this intense focus on his health for years now, but especially after the disastrous debate performance less than a year ago, that performance that ultimately led to him dropping out of the race for president.
And I want to talk more about that. But before we get to that, I mean, reactions have been pouring in to this diagnosis or the news of this diagnosis. Any of them stand out to you?
You know, President Trump, who spends a lot of time trashing Biden, was quite gracious, writing on social media that he and the First Lady were saddened to hear about his diagnosis and wished Biden a fast and successful recovery. Former Vice President Kamala Harris posted, quote, "I know he will face this challenge with the same strength, resilience, and optimism that have always defined his life and leadership."
Now, Tam, you talked about his decline while in office and the focus of that. And this is all happening in a week where there was already going to be a focus on the former president because of the release of a book about his health while in office, right?
Yeah, the book is called Original Sin, written by CNN's Jake Tapper and Alex Thompson from Axios, and it alleges that Biden experienced both a physical and cognitive decline while in office, and that those closest to him covered it up. In an interview with NPR's Scott Detrow that will air on All Things Considered later today, Tapper said everyone loses their train of thought or forgets a name from time to time, but this was different.
We're talking about to the point of you are not able to have a conversation. You are not able to come up with data, information, knowledge, names that you should have at the ready.
Including not recognizing George Clooney at a fundraiser. Biden on The View said the authors are wrong and there is nothing to sustain their claims.
Now, the claims in this book, are there broader implications here about Biden's fitness while in office?
Yet this is likely to be an extended and uncomfortable news cycle for Democrats who are trying to move on and restore trust with voters. Voters who made it clear they thought Biden was too old to run for re-election well before the Democratic establishment acknowledged it. But the midterm elections are nearly 18 months away. The economy and President Trump's leadership are almost certainly going to be bigger issues than Joe Biden, who is already in the rearview mirror. And in a week where Republicans are trying to advance Trump's one big beautiful bill, which includes both tax cuts and spending cuts, Democratic politicians would much rather be talking about what's in that bill than rehashing the political tragedy of Joe Biden.
NPR's Tamara Keith, thank you for joining us, Tam.
You're welcome.
Dr. Ben Davies has been reading the statement of the former president. He's a professor of urology at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine and is here with some analysis. Good morning.
Good morning.
The one thing that I know about prostate cancer as a layman is that most men, nearly all men, are said to survive it. It's not supposed to be that bad. But in this case, we hear of something called a Gleason score of 9 and metastasis to the bone, which sounds very bad. So what do these things mean in layman's terms?
Yes, Steve, I wish I could disabuse you of some of those notions. Prostate cancer kills over 40,000 people a year in America. Of course, many men do not die from it. Actually, the majority do not die from it. In the president's case, he has a very bad version of it, probably the worst version you can get, and it has gone to his bones. Obviously, I don't know the extent of the disease, but there are some good options for him. And that could include hormonal injections, which should kind of calm it down and take away some of the testosterone levels in his body so that the disease stops growing quite as fast and can kind of almost melt away from the bones. He also can get chemotherapy, which is a great study that happened just a few years ago, which could extend his life if he qualifies for it. And radiation therapy, too, is definitely in play, which also has been proven to extend life in patients with newly diagnosed metastatic prostate cancer. So he's got quite a lot of things he could do. I think frailty is an issue for him because some of the medicines can increase some of the frailty aspects of life. But it's not all doom and gloom, to be honest. He can easily live 10 years with this disease. In fact, I think about the median life is about 5 to 7 years from newly diagnosed metastatic prostate cancer. But he could easily go over that.
You mentioned frailty being an issue here. Are your options limited somewhat when you're 82?
No, I don't think so. There's lots of different 82s. I've met marathoners, you know, who are 82-year-old. So it's not really an age-specific thing. It's more the, you know, physiology and how he can take the therapies that he's getting.
Are you surprised at all that we would learn about this quite suddenly from a single screening and that it's an advanced case that we presume, from what we know, was not noticed or caught earlier?
Oh, boy, it's a little bit of an intellectual question, I think, Steve. You know, it's a humble business being a physician. And, you know, even if you screen regularly, many patients, you know, we can't find the disease before it's already in your bones. You can't screen away, you know, prostate cancer. It's going to happen to every physician. So I wasn't that surprised, to be honest with you.
So if someone asks questions, and of course questions are already being asked about the president's health while he was president, if someone raised the question of whether there should have been something said or noticed about this while he was president, you would not say there automatically should have been?
No, I think that would be ridiculous. No.
So what resources would you recommend for people who are in the former president's position, who are asking questions about their own health?
Sure. I think, you know, if you're an 80-year-old man and you're wondering whether or not you have prostate cancer, obviously you should see your primary care physician and go over, you know, what it means to be screened. We do not, as a profession, screen men in their 80s for prostate cancer for a variety of reasons, most of which you've mentioned, because most prostate cancers found in that age are indolent. So if you screened a population of patients for prostate cancer in their 80s, you would be getting all kinds of diseases you didn't need to know about and adding unwarranted worry to those patients. So I would talk to your primary care physician about what it means to be screened, the pluses and the minuses. And I would actually recommend not to screen most 80-year-old men.
Really? So what is the age where you should be getting screened?
There's actually a few definitions, but between 50 and 70 are the current recommendations for most organizations.
And you said something at the beginning. You said 40,000 people die of prostate cancer, and yet the common wisdom that came to me was that it's easily treatable, that you can do something about this, and most people are fine. Why is it that 40,000 people are still dying if there are so many treatments available?
Oh, well, you're asking me a tricky question, but I mean, obviously people get cancer all the time and pass away from it. So it's not uncommon with prostate cancer to pass away with it. I think I'd like to emphasize a few things, Steve, if you'll let me.
Yeah.
We've had made major gains in prostate cancer care in the metastatic space over the past 10 years and really extended life. So there's no reason to think that the president can't really have an extended life with metastatic prostate cancer. 10 years is not unheard of with disease in your bones. We will only make headway into prostate cancer care with careful and robust funding of our science institutions, which I'm really hoping will continue. And that will pave the way for future people who get the disease the president has.
This is something that the president himself advocated for. Dr. Ben Davies, professor of urology at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. Thanks for your insights. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
The centrist pro-European mayor of Bucharest was elected president of Romania yesterday, beating a right-wing Eurosceptic. NPR's Central Europe correspondent Rob Schmitz reports that the contest was seen as a litmus test over whether populist nationalism or Western democracy would prevail.
With nearly all the ballots counted, preliminary official results show 54% of Romanian voters choosing Bucharest Mayor Nicu Șordan as their president. His opponent was Georgia Simion, a nationalist and admirer of President Donald Trump. And while he received just 46% of the vote, Simion claimed victory and called for national protests, railing against what he said was an attempt to, quote, steal the victory of the Romanian people.
But I think the safety of the large difference made that impossible.
Clara Volintiru is regional director of the Black Sea Trust for Regional Cooperation, a project of the German Marshall Fund of the United States, a public policy think tank.
Even if Nicu Șordan would have won, but would have won by a small margin, then social unrest would have followed today.
Volintiru says Dan's result of just 20% of the vote in the first round of the election to become today's winner was an amazing comeback by the centrist independent politician. But his victory will likely anger many right-wing politicians abroad, including J.D. Vance. He criticized a Romanian court's decision last year to annul the first round of this presidential election after state intelligence revealed that Russia interfered in the election, a claim Moscow denies. Volintiru says this second round's margin of victory, though, is enough to quiet these critics.
The fact that there was a big difference, a clear win, has really reestablished the faith in the democratic process in Romania, both domestically and abroad.
She says it'll also calm fears in Europe that the democratic backsliding seen in parts of Central and Eastern Europe is not happening in Romania, a country that borders Ukraine and plays a key role in defending NATO's eastern flank against Russia. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
This is NPR News.
KUAC is your lifeline, providing life-saving emergency alerts, trusted information, and educational resources to interior Alaskans. But all of that is at risk. Eliminating already approved public media funding could end these essential services. Urge Congress to protect the federal funding that makes KUAC possible at protectmypublicmedia.org.
Coming up this hour for the KUAC News, the Bureau of Investigation releases the names of the cops and the troopers who killed a suspect last Monday. Also, smoke jumpers put out their first fire of the season, and the UA regents are taking testimony this afternoon. We'll have those stories for you and more coming up in 10 minutes for the KUAC 730 News. KUAC is supported by Jen Gunderson Design, specializing in logo and brand identity design, print materials, and custom illustrations. More information at jengunderson.com.
The Broadway play Oh Mary is a crazy comic reimagining of First Lady Mary Todd Lincoln in the days leading up to her husband's assassination. The New York Times calls it one of the best comedies in years, and it's received Tony nominations, including Best Play and Best Leading Actor. On the next Fresh Air, writer and star Cola Scola. Join us.
Coming up this morning at 11 o'clock on KUAC.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from National Geographic Lindblad Expeditions, committed to taking travelers deeper into the wonders of planet Earth. Each expedition cruise is guided by a diverse team. NatGeoExpeditions.com/cruises. From EBSCO, providing researchers with access to biomedical and healthcare literature reviews, with the goal of helping them conduct thorough reviews in less time. Learn more at EBSCO.com. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Israel's military has begun extensive ground operations throughout Gaza. At the same time, Israelis say they will allow in some food, just as a United Nations-backed group raised the odds of famine. The many perspectives we're hearing include Yusri Al-Ghul. We called him late last week and reached him on a scratchy phone line. He was in North Gaza, where he lives with his wife and four children. Yusri. It's Steve Inskeep.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Hi, doing okay. Thank you for taking the time to talk today. I really appreciate it.
I'm just closing the windows of my tent, so just to be available to talk to you.
Did you say closing the windows of your tent?
Yes, I did.
He says he's a writer. Years ago, he worked for the Gaza Ministry of Culture. He says he doesn't support Hamas today and favors releasing hostages while also repeatedly accusing Israel of genocide, a charge Israelis deny. We asked him to describe daily life, and as you will hear, the conversation took a turn.
Yeah, I'm in the north of Gaza. I didn't leave it. I have two houses. They were severely demolished, so I put my tent in the rubble of my house.
So you are on the location of your former home, surrounded by rubble.
Yes.
How are you feeding yourself and your family at this time?
My friend, we are in a famine. We just have some bread. And that's it. And even the bread. I'm always telling my children, please don't eat all of this bread. This is for the morning, and that is for the evening. And that's it. We don't find water. We don't find electricity. We don't find internet. They're saying that they want to evacuate us. Please come and take us out of Gaza. We want to leave it. We want to leave Gaza because you destroyed everything.
Did you just say if you had an offer to go live somewhere else, you would take it?
Sure. Not only me. 90% of the Palestinians. We don't have anything here in the Gaza Strip to stay. We don't have water. We don't have food. We just have bloodshed. Then you ask me, will you stay here? No, I want to leave it.
What is your feeling right now about Hamas?
Sure. Listen to me, my friend. If you ask me about what happened of the 7th of October and blah, 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 what happened before 6th of October, what happened in the West Bank, which is the Hamas, not a part of the government in the West Bank. The Israelis always killing the Palestinians, even in the Gaza Strip and in the West Bank.
I want to assure you that I've covered that region for years, that I've been to the West Bank and Gaza. I understand the argument that you're making, your side of the story about the history. I'm just interested now in this moment what your attitude is toward Hamas, which would seem to be the strongest Palestinian force in Gaza.
There was no Hamas here, my friend. Just to let you know, the Israeli killed all of them. They destroyed the whole buildings of Hamas. They destroyed even the buildings of the civilians. So my viewpoint about Hamas is like my viewpoint about the radical government, Israeli government. They both are terrorists. I do believe that we need to integrate in a diverse world. We need to be in touch. We need to build a two-state solution, which is refused by the Israeli government.
You mentioned that the only thing you've had to eat lately is bread. Where do you get it? Where does it come from?
In the time of truce, before 2 months, they opened the borders for just 50 days, I think. When they brought the food and the aid, and this time I tried to bring it and to buy and to hide it, because I believe the Israeli also will come again and to make this a starvation and to fight us in a famine in the Gaza Strip. You know that we have a dream. I'm always telling my wife that I wish I could have a plate of salad. I wish I could see tomato with cucumber and with other kind. And even the melon, we don't have it. Just imagine, you don't have these things.
And because you said you would be willing to leave Gaza if someone would just let you leave, you, I presume, have heard that President Trump talked about removing the Gaza population and rebuilding Gaza as a seaside resort and finding someplace else for Palestinians to live. What do you think about that idea?
Listen to me, my friend. I think, I'm sorry to say that. I know that I'm talking to American people, but this is a lunatic idea. I'm not going to talk about the man. I'm talking about, I do respect the power of Mr. Trump. I don't mind to leave Gaza, but not to Egypt or to Jordan. I wish I could have the opportunity to go to Canada and to go to the United States. We are just 2 million. We are not a very crowded number of Palestinians.
If you could come to the United States, you would give up Gaza. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I wish I could come to the United States with my family. I wish I could have.
Yusriel Gul, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
He spoke last week in Gaza before Israeli forces escalated operations.
Tens of thousands of people filled St. Peter's Square in Vatican City to witness the inaugural Mass of Pope Leo XIV. Leo is the first American to lead the Catholic Church. He promised to protect the Catholic tradition, and in a gesture of humility, he said, "I was chosen without any merit of my own."
Sono stato scelto senza alcun merito, e con timore e tremore vengo a voi come un fratello.
Speaking in Italian, Leo added, "I come to you as a brother who wants to be a servant." He spoke of a world reconciled.
Che diventi fermento per un mondo riconciliato.
Having said that, Leo was like his predecessor, Pope Francis, in offering strong views on divisive issues. Leo criticized a world economic system that exploits the Earth's resources and sidelines the poorest.
Che sfrutta le risorse della terra ed emargina i più poveri.
Our correspondent Ruth Sherlock heard a few of the responses from the crowd at St. Peter's, among them Joel McMichael, who's a seminarian from Texas.
I'm hopeful for he's wanting to address issues of media and AI and these kind of things. He seems that's an important thing.
Francesca Monteruli from southern Italy took issue with his remarks on marriage.
La cosa che a me non è piaciuta.
She says, "I didn't like that he says that the family is made up of a mother and a father." Monteruli says she believes God loves everyone regardless of who they are.
Another person in the crowd was Melissa Hale of Georgia.
We are very hopeful that Pope Leo will be able to take the church forward into the future.
She says she's excited about his calls for peace. This is NPR News.
Sometimes it seems like the news industry is one big runaway train headed way too fast, destination unknown. I'm Elsa Chang. At All Things Considered, we plan our daily voyage carefully and take the time to see the important sights along the way. Don't worry, we'll still get you where you need to go. All Things Considered from NPR News. Enjoy the journey.
Coming up this afternoon at 4, on KUAC. KUAC is supported by folks in Healy, Haynes, and in Homer. We do want to thank you for your continued support for KUAC's public broadcasting services. Coming up next is the NPR News, followed by the KUAC News. The time right now is 7:30.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The White House confirms a high-stakes call is underway between Presidents Trump and Putin of Russia. So far, Trump's been unable to get Putin to agree to end its war with Ukraine. A legislative package of President Trump's domestic priorities now heads to the full House for a vote, but its fate is still far from certain. Democrats are united against it, and the GOP leadership's promised modifications to appease hardline Republicans who want deeper spending cuts to pay for the bill's tax cuts, among them Congressman Ralph Norman of South Carolina. He was among several Republicans unhappy with the bill, but who voted present so the measure could advance out of the House Budget Committee last evening.
Had some great changes. We got a lot more to work to do. We're excited about what we did. We wanted to move the bill forward, and it went like I thought.
Fiscal hawks' demands include speeding up enforcement of Medicaid work requirements and phasing out clean energy subsidies. The New Jersey Transit rail strike's over, not in time to normalize services this morning, but New Jersey Transit head Chris Colluri says things should be back on schedule in tomorrow morning for some 100,000 daily commuters.
We are now going to work from tonight till Tuesday morning to get the rails operational so we can get everybody back to a sense of normalcy.
Management struck a tentative deal with hundreds of unionized locomotive engineers yesterday. The agreement is subject to union ratification. From Washington, this is NPR News. Yesterday, Portugal held its third general election in as many years. NPR's Miguel Macias with details.
Portugal's incumbent prime minister, conservative Luis Montenegro, had hoped that Sunday's general elections would yield a decisive majority in parliament for his party, the Democratic Alliance. Montenegro didn't prove his party's results, but ironically, Portugal now seems headed for another minority government, precisely the situation that has taken voters to the polls three times in the past 3 years. The two-party system appears to be a thing of the past, with far-right party Chega in the cusp of surpassing the Socialist Party as the second most voted option. Incumbent Prime Minister Luis Montenegro will now face the difficult task of reaching agreements with other parties to govern while avoiding a coalition with the far-right. Miguel Macias, NPR News.
The genetic testing company 23andMe has a potential buyer 2 months after it filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. The biotech company Regeneron is offering $256 million. The pharmaceutical firm says it will comply with 23andMe's privacy policies, a central point of concern for customers seeking to shield their genetic data from security breaches. A court still has to approve the sale. A hearing is scheduled June 17th. The Dow is down 61 points. From Washington, this is NPR News.
Forgetting something, whether it's a colleague's name or where we put our keys, can make us feel like our memory is faulty. But is that really true?
Forgetting is not just a side effect of memory. It's not memory failing. It's part of what memory is supposed to do.
Why our minds were built to forget. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Coming up this morning at 10 o'clock on KUAC. Coming up next is the KUAC News. First, we'll have a quick look at the weather. From the Fairbanks Airport, 45 degrees and a few clouds. Scattered rain showers expected mainly after 1 o'clock this afternoon and with high temperatures near 60.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
Good morning. With KUAC News, I'm Robin. Authorities have released the names of 7 law enforcement officers who were involved in the fatal shooting of a suspect in Fairbanks last week. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The shooting occurred at around 10:30 p.m. last Monday, the 12th, after Fairbanks police responded to a report of a domestic disturbance on Washington Drive. When officers arrived, 36-year-old Thomas Bean opened fire with a semi-automatic rifle, hitting several squad cars. Police returned fire, and several more city police and Alaska State Troopers arrived for backup. And after Bean refused to surrender, 7 officers fatally shot him. Following the melee, investigators discovered that Bean had fatally shot 29-year-old Jesse Bidgood of North Pole. His body and Bean's both were sent to the state medical examiner's office for autopsy. On Friday, the Alaska Bureau of Investigation released the names of the officers who fired their weapons. The Alaska State Troopers identified are Sergeant Brent Hatch, Trooper Zachary Chicoine, and Trooper Peter Testa. The Fairbanks police officers identified are Officer Chris Conrad, Officer Nathan Jackson, Officer James Kuplak, and Officer Michael Sullivan. The Bureau of Investigation is looking into the case, and that investigation will then be independently reviewed by the Alaska Office of Special Prosecutions. For KUAC News, I'm Tim Ellis.
State lawmakers have until Wednesday to finish up their work for the year. Both houses worked over the weekend to pass each other's bills, and early last night they set this year's permanent fund dividend at $1,000 per Alaskan. They still must vote on a budget with deep cuts because diminished oil prices and a turbulent national economy have cut revenue. A conference committee has been negotiating the differences between what comes out of the House and what comes out of the Senate so that the same budget bill can pass through both chambers and get to Governor Mike Dunleavy's desk. Several budget items were settled over the weekend. Smoke jumpers for the joint BLM-Alaska Fire Service made the season's first jump on a wildfire near Central Saturday night. The Crooked Fire was estimated at 15 acres, burning about 7.5 miles west of Central. It was threatening campers and heavy equipment nearby. The fire was reported Saturday morning by someone in the area who saw it burning in grass and shrubs. 12 smoke jumpers contained the fire by about 10 p.m. Saturday and remained on scene overnight to fully extinguish the fire. They finished their mop-up and demobilized around midday yesterday. U.S. Customs and Border Protection opened the Poker Creek Port of Entry Sunday. It's the agency's farthest north border crossing that connects the Taylor Highway in Eastern Interior to the Top of the World Highway in the Yukon, which leads to Dawson City, Canada. The Poker Creek Port of Entry is located about 40 miles east of Chicken on a short stretch of the Taylor Highway up to the turnoff to Boundary Spur Road, which leads to the Yukon border. That port of entry opens every year at around this time after the Alaska Department of Transportation snowplows the Taylor Highway and opens the overland route to Canada. The port of entry is scheduled to remain open until mid-September, but a Customs and Border Protection news release issued Friday advises travelers that the agency may adjust the closing date on short notice in case of adverse weather conditions. Agency officials also want to remind travelers that passports are required to travel between Alaska and the Yukon. They say firewood from Canada cannot be brought into Alaska. More information is available on the Customs and Border Protection page on the Department of Homeland Security website, DHS.gov. The University of Alaska Board of Regents will hear public comments this afternoon from 4 to 5 p.m. This is an opportunity to talk directly with the regents. Each caller will have 2 minutes to offer thoughts, feedback, or updates on topics or issues related to the UA system. In addition to the opportunity to provide public testimony, written testimony is accepted any time. The regents will have committee meetings on Wednesday and a full board meeting on Wednesday and Thursday on the Trothiadoc campus at University of Alaska Fairbanks. They will hear a progress report on implementing the board's February motion related to removing references to diversity, equity, and inclusion. Board meeting agendas and the phone number to call for testimony this afternoon can be found on the UA Board of Regents website. Tribal leaders from across the country spoke out last week at a United States Senate hearing against changes within the Department of Health and Human Services. Alaskans are also eyeing how potential cuts to the department's Indian Health Service would affect Native communities here. The Alaska Desk's Aljona Naiden has more.
The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services announced in March that it would cut 20,000 health jobs, consolidate some of its divisions, and close regional offices. That was in response to an executive order from President Trump to optimize the workforce across the federal government. The Senate hearing looked at how that decision could harm HHS programs that benefit Native Americans. Senator Lisa Murkowski chaired the hearing.
These aren't just federal services, they're really critical components of the social safety net. My view is that these programs support family stability, child development, and basic dignity.
Child care, services for domestic violence victims, and substance abuse prevention. One of the witnesses at the hearing was Melissa Charlie, the executive director of the Fairbanks Native Association. The association provides a tribal Head Start program to hundreds of children in the interior, offering them educational and cultural activities. The association also receives HHS funds for emergency shelter and services for survivors of domestic violence. Charlie says more than half of their clients reported family violence last year.
As women leave a domestic violence situation with just the clothes on their back, they can't afford the temporary housing, not in Fairbanks and especially in remote Alaska.
Others who spoke at the hearing said that staff layoffs have been carried out without proper communication with the tribes. The Senate hearing focused on HHS programs that are not part of the Indian Health Service, which is an agency within the department. But that agency might also be facing changes. The Trump administration has proposed to reduce the HHS budget, which includes cutting $900 million, nearly 30%, from the Indian Health Service. William Smith is the National Indian Health Board Chairman and the Valdez Native Tribe Chief. In an interview last month, he said the proposal would lead to closure of clinics, losses of essential staffing, and an increase in preventative deaths in Native communities.
When we talk about the budget cuts to the Indian Health Service, these are not just budget numbers, you know, these are our lives.
Smith says that the federal government has treaty and trust obligations to ensure Native people have access to health care.
We paid with our land, we paid with our health, we paid with our culture.
I am Alona Knighton.
And finally, a correction. We reported Friday that Kinross investor presentations suggested the Manh Choh mine's production life would extend to 2030. That date was instead referring to the Fort Knox mine north of Fairbanks. A spokesperson for Kinross says they expect Manh Choh production and the ore haul to end in late 2028 or early 2029, although it remains possible for further exploration to extend the mine's life. And a note that Kinross Alaska Manh Choh is a KUAC corporate underwriter. For KUAC, I'm Robin.
You can find local stories and past KUAC newscasts at fm.kuac.org.
KUAC wishes a very happy birthday to KUAC Kids Club members. Grace, Catherine, Rain, Penny, Izzy, Hendrix, Kelson, Madison, Theo, and Lily. Happy May birthday. Learn more at KUAC.org. KUAC Kids Club is sponsored by Alaska 529. One plan, many paths.
Thanks for joining us this morning here at KUAC. The Tanana Valley Watershed Association is inviting local artists to submit designs to the 2025 Storm Drain Art Contest in downtown Fairbanks. That is until Saturday, May 24th at midnight. You can email your proposed artwork with a title and a short description and your contact information, and that is to tvwatershed@gmail.com. More information is at tvwatershed.org.
I'm Scott Tong. Key minerals make batteries, weapons, and medical technologies. A lot live on the ocean floor, which has never been commercially mined. President Trump wants to change that. But what's the environmental risk?
We're not going to learn those things until we start exploring and extracting. You can't model this stuff. You have to measure it.
Next time, here and now.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. Contractors in Central Florida conducted a routine inspection of a stormwater pipe. They sent a robotic camera looking for cracks, which instead found an alligator, 5 feet long, relaxing in the water. The city posted the video, and now the alligator has a fan base who gave it a nickname, the Pipe Puppy. Officials don't seem bothered. Alligators can easily get in and out of storm drains, so he can leave when he's ready, and nobody's going to make him. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Here's the latest change for cryptocurrency under President Trump. A crypto exchange becomes listed as one of the big companies that are used to track the broader economy. People follow different indices of stocks. The Dow tracks 30 industrial companies, for example. The S&P 500 is a broader index of big companies, and the S&P 500 now includes a crypto firm for the first time. NPR senior business editor Rafael Nam is covering this. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
How did we get to this?
Well, I really don't think it's an exaggeration to say that for the crypto sector, everything changed when Trump became president again. Now, keep in mind, for years, crypto was this weird and fringe investment. But now a radical change is taking place. Crypto is going legit. Coinbase joining the S&P is the latest sign of that. They are a big exchange for trading all kinds of cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. Here's Brian Armstrong, the CEO of Coinbase, in an interview with Yahoo Finance.
Coinbase joining the S&P 500 means crypto's here to stay. It's going to be in everybody's 401k. Everyone's going to have crypto exposure, you know, at least indirectly through Coinbase.
And a big part of why this is happening is President Trump.
If people buy a mutual fund, if they buy a stock index fund, it may be based on the S&P 500, and they're effectively buying Coinbase, although not directly. So why is it that Trump has been able to drive this change?
Because he's embraced crypto in a way that's unprecedented. He even stands to gain from it. Early this year, he launched his own meme coin called Simply Trump.
Right.
And these are cryptocurrencies that are associated with internet memes, essentially things that are trending. And this Wednesday, he's invited over 200 of the top buyers of his meme coin for a dinner. Now, that's raising concerns that investors from all around the world who have bought this cryptocurrency could find a way to influence the president. The White House has been denying this, saying these are private ventures, but President Trump's own sons are also deeply involved in crypto ventures. It's another way people think companies and countries could try to influence the president.
Is the administration also changing regulation of this industry in which the president is personally involved along with his family?
Yes, in a very substantial way, Steve. I'm talking specifically about the Securities and Exchange Commission. This is the federal agency that's effectively the top cop for Wall Street. And under President Biden, the SEC took a very tough approach to crypto. About 2 years ago, the agency even sued Coinbase for not following the same rules that every Wall Street firm does. But under this administration, they have dropped the lawsuit and are taking a much less aggressive stance.
Who, if anybody, is raising concerns here?
Well, consumer advocates are certainly alarmed because crypto has this incredible history of volatility, right? A history of big gains, yeah, but also big crashes. And this is a sector sort of infamous for being used in all kinds of fraud and illegal activities. So just over 2 years ago, another crypto exchange, FTX, collapsed, if you remember. But now Coinbase is joining the S&P. And in the scope of literally just months, we've gone from the US government saying, hey, this could be dangerous for average Americans who might be buying into something they don't really understand, to President Trump declaring that the US should be the crypto capital of the planet.
NPR's Rafael Nam is the capital of crypto correspondence. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
This is NPR News.
Former President Jimmy Carter's death has Alaskans reflecting on how he shaped the state. Carter signed an ILCA, doubling the size of America's national park system, vastly expanding wildlife refuges and other set-asides. Many Alaskans were angry, saying the 1980 law locked up land, but it also gave Alaskans certain access rights that are unique in federal land management. We'll discuss the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act on the next Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is coming up Tuesday morning at 10 on KUAC. And this episode of Talk of Alaska is a rebroadcast, so calls will not be taken at that time. KUAC is supported by the Fountainhead Antique Auto Museum, displaying a collection of vehicles and a journey through U.S. automotive history, paired with vintage fashions, open Sunday and Wednesday from 11 to 5. Information at fountainheadmuseum.com. So we take a look at the weather in Fairbanks. It is 41 degrees. Pardon me, not the latest here, 45 degrees, with just a few clouds. In Bettles, it is 40 degrees with light rain. And just a few clouds everywhere else at this time in our listening communities. Nome is 31 degrees. Tok is 48. Eagle is 41. Healy, Nanana, and Delta are all 45 degrees. This weather update is sponsored by Samard Automotive. Time right now is 7:51. Join us for more Morning Edition at 8 o'clock is 2 hours of Here and Now.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Layla Faldin. 400 years old. That's the age of the oldest bonsai tree in North America. Its birthday was celebrated this month, and NPR's Destiny Adams was there.
On a recent sunny morning at the National Bonsai and Panjing Museum at the National Arboretum, a crowd of visitors are taking turns admiring the peace tree.
A literal translation of bonsai is a tree in a pot, or a plant in a pot, or a tree in a tray, if you like alliteration.
That's Aaron Stratton. The former president of the American Bonsai Society sports a large straw hat and a wide, contagious grin as he gestures toward the Yamaki pine, about 2 feet tall in a black rectangular pot, its green foliage perfectly trimmed.
It is the tree in this national collection that has been cared for as a bonsai for the longest amount of time, been in a pot, taken care of by people for 400 years. And that's an amazing thing.
This tree has survived a lot. It was first potted in Hiroshima, Japan, 400 years ago by the Yamaki family, a family known for operating a commercial bonsai nursery in the city for several generations. The bonsai survived the U.S. bombing of the city in 1945. Here's a video from the U.S. War Department describing the scene.
The bomb was exploded above the city, and in the towering mushroom, Japan could read its doom.
Over 30 years later, Japan gifted 53 bonsai trees, including this one, to the United States as a sort of peace offering for its bicentennial. Michael James is the curator of the museum, and he calls bonsai an art form.
That is a multi-generational art, so it's passed down, it's passed forward to others. That's how it brings people together.
Guy Guidry is a bonsai artist from New Orleans, Louisiana, and he has a tree on display.
Could you take us over to it?
It'd be a pleasure.
In American flag boots, he marches over to his tree, which stands out among the rest. It has no leaves, and it is meticulously wrapped in a jet black wire. Guidry says he adopted his first bonsai 30 years ago from a neighbor who had neglected the plant.
Growing bonsai is just like growing a dog or a cat or having a child. It's something you can't neglect.
Guidry laughs as he reminisces about all the friends and bonsai mentors he's met in the past 3 decades. He is a proud embodiment of what this anniversary represents: togetherness, friendship, and peace. Destiny Adams, NPR News.
If you're trying to build up muscle, you need protein. So does it matter if that protein comes from meat or from plants? NPR's Will Stone flexes some reporting muscle on the evidence.
It was a long-held belief that making gains in the gym requires meat. This wasn't a matter of bro science. Nicholas Bird says this is what the well-controlled studies were finding.
It was certainly ingrained in my mind that animal's better than plant, right?
Bird researches exercise and nutrition at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. The issue here is protein quality. Amino acids are the building blocks of our muscles, and meat has an abundance of the ones we need to grow them.
It should make sense. If you're eating meat, you're eating basically muscle, right? So that protein mirrors our skeletal muscle in terms of its amino acid composition.
Plant proteins also have the essential amino acids, but some are in lower concentrations.
They're lower quality when you view a single plant-based meal versus an animal-based meal.
But does this mean you can't build muscle as well on plant protein? Actually, no. The evidence for this has been growing in recent years. Some of the latest data comes from Bird's lab. He followed healthy young adults over 9 days and 3 weightlifting sessions. Everyone ate the same amount of protein, but some were vegan, others omnivores. Here's what they found when they analyzed the muscle tissue at the end of the study.
The muscle building potential, and likely, based on our data, the long-term muscle mass gains would be the same.
It's not that earlier research was wrong. Benjamin Wall at the University of Exeter says it just didn't give the full picture.
One of the main reasons why people assumed an inferiority of plant versus animal proteins was the studies that were a single meal, a single protein over a few hours.
But the story changed with longer studies that mixed up the sources of plant protein.
We now have several studies which suggest there's far less difference.
So long as people are mindful about what they eat. For example, peas are a good source of the amino acid leucine, which is critical for switching on protein synthesis, but it's low in methionine, so you can look for that somewhere else, like in rice. These studies make it easy. They give the participants well-balanced meals.
What they don't do is address the real-world challenge that it is probably harder to consume higher protein diets and you have fewer choices as a vegan.
And meat is more protein-dense, so you can end up eating more calories to get the same amount from plants. Exactly how much is enough protein is another, sometimes divisive question. This depends on your activity level, your goals, your age. The University of Illinois study focused on building muscle. People ate 1.2 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. That's 50% more than what U.S. guidelines recommend, but pretty representative of how Americans are eating. James McKendry at the University of British Columbia says it's a reasonable target. You can bump that up to as high as 1.6 grams.
Really looking to squeeze out the maximum amount of protein, and beyond that point, there's really diminishing returns.
And McKendry says, remember, protein, wherever you get it from, is just one ingredient in the muscle-building equation.
Protein is really the icing on the cake for building muscle. And doesn't matter how much you consume, if you're not progressively resistance training, you're not going to build much muscle at all.
Here, research is very clear. Longevity, cardiovascular health, brain function, all of this improves when you challenge your muscles and pick up some weights. Will Stone, NPR News.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from BetterHelp, committed to making mental well-being a priority and offering support in taking on everything life demands, with therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone at BetterHelp.com/public.
Don't know about you, Layla, but I'm going to have to get out and exercise a little bit.
Maybe.
Think? Yeah. Maybe. Maybe. But not you. You'll be exercising sometime.
Me. Yeah. Sometimes. You're maybe
fit.
One day.
You're fit. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Stephen Skeep.
And I'm Layla Faldin.
Have I sent for my baby? And she don't come. Have I sent for my baby? And she don't come. All the doctors in Wisconsin, he won't help her no. yes, she gets on too late and gets what she don't want to. My baby gets on too late.